Hi, my name is Bob Lahan. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I don't believe there are any coincidences, and I happen to believe that life is just a series of experiences, and we keep doing things over and over and over again until we get it right. I was a speaker up here a number of years ago, and I don't know what I did wrong then, but I'm here apparently to correct it. So maybe if I don't correct it, I'll come back again sometime, huh? So maybe I'd like to have it that way. The thing between Caroline and I regarding the most unlovable people really wasn't supposed to get out in public. But my wife was real quick to point out that, say, if I'm judging that somebody else isn't working that program, doesn't that mean I'm not working my program and judging other people? And I said, yeah, that's right. So, but it's nice to be here. I appreciate the invitation, appreciate the hospitality, and it's real nice seeing friends and new friends at one of these conferences. I always like to point out that had you ever thought that we're all a bunch of failures? Did anybody come into this program as a success? But you know, the paradox of that is that once we come in here and admit we're a failure, we become a success. So we're all failures. But as a person who doesn't admit they're a failure is not a success in this program. They have trouble with the program. So we have to first of all admit that we're a failure. And that's one of the nice things about it. But something that we have in our Al-Anon literature, which we read at every Al-Anon meeting, and a lot of times we pass over, talks about the change in our attitude. How living with an alcoholic, it doesn't talk anything about a drinking alcoholic, just says alcoholic. So that can be a sober alcoholic too. It says, without spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. And a change in our attitude becomes necessary. So I kind of get the impression that without spiritual help, my attitude can't change. Or I have difficulty changing my attitude. Then there's something that that's read in our One Day at a Time book, which I think is either the biggest lie that's ever been published and should be taken out of there, or it's the most profound truth that has ever been written. And it says that there's something like that down at the bottom. It said, if I work the fourth through the tenth step, the change in me will be reflected in every person who crosses my path. Now, if I understand that correctly, when I change, you change. Now, it occurred to me a number of years ago, that I come to these functions, bunches of failures, and they're all a bunch of beautiful people. And it suddenly dawned on me, did you know it is I who make you beautiful? Now, I'm not trying to say that you can't help. But it is my final decision that makes you beautiful. It's my perception of you that creates your beauty. A change in my attitude makes you beautiful. The change in your attitude, or your attitude, determines whether the person sitting across the table from you is beautiful, or the person sitting next to you is beautiful. That's your decision. It's not their decision. And this is really what Al-Anon is all about. So I like to talk about what Al-Anon does and what it has done for me, what it's my understanding of it, my perception of it. A number of years ago, there was a member of AA that came to an Al-Anon meeting, a beginner's meeting. And after the meeting, she said, Bob, you sure talk a lot about the alcoholic here, don't you? And I said, oh, yeah, don't you talk about your obsession when you go to AA meetings? So I have to talk about my obsession, which is my wife. And I have to talk about my reaction to it. Just like members of AA, when they go and talk about their obsession with alcohol, they have to talk about their reaction to alcohol. So I have to talk about her and my reaction. Now, if I don't ever talk about my reaction to what she did, then it becomes gossip. And hopefully I don't gossip. But I have to talk about how I perceive what she was doing. Now, if you ever listen to her, she doesn't see it the way I saw it. So we all have our own perception. So all I'm going to try to do is share my own perception. There's an Al-Anon joke. for us Al-Anons, but you can listen to it if you're members of AA, about the forest ranger that was going up the trail one time. They came upon a clearing, and there was a great big old grizzly bear just knocking the devil out of this alcoholic. And his wife was standing there with a rifle. And the ranger said, "Kill him, kill him." And she was saying, "I was hoping the bear would do it for me." A lot of time is spent talking about alcoholism, and I personally feel that there's an illness that I have called Al-Anonism. We don't describe it in Al-Anon as an illness. We talk about alcoholism being the family illness, but I kind of got to pinpoint a little bit closer and maybe say I'm an Al-Anonic, suffering from a disease called Al-Anonism. And my description of it is the neurotic compulsion to stop the drinking of a person who has a neurotic compulsion to drink. I spent a lot of time trying to stop her from drinking, and I became a neurotic, thinking that I had control. And it wasn't until I came into Al-Anon that I recovered from that compulsion. I did not do that by my intellect. I did not do that by clear thinking. I did not do that by reading our literature. I did not do that by talking about it. Something happened to me. A member of AA one time said that all of us have had a spiritual experience. And by that he means that in everybody's story, there will be a point when somebody, that person will say, "And then something happened." So what do you mean, something happened? Well, I don't know, just something happened. That indescribable something, that thing that maybe made the turn inside of us. And he pointed out that that is the intervention of God. That indescribable something that we don't really know what happened, the coincidence, whatever it might be, but that which turned us around in some manner. And it takes that, I believe, for me to get over my illness, and I think it takes that for other people to get over their illness. There's a biblical story about alcoholism. I don't know how many of you read the Bible. I like to tell this down in the Baptist country. But if you remember, there was a story of the alcoholic. I may not have this right, by the way. But there was a bunch of... there was an alcoholic down by the well. And there was a big crowd around that alcoholic, berating the alcoholic, saying all these nasty things, berating it, and... a man stepped forward and he said, "You who are without sin, cast the first stone." And here comes a big rock thrown by the spouse of that alcoholic. That also is for Al-Anon use only. I did a lot of judging of my wife, and I did a lot of berating of her, and I did a lot of put-downs. They say that we always get back what we give, and I am now having to endure some of that myself now, by the way. But Goldine was always my teacher. The alcoholic in my life is my teacher. Now, I don't like some of the lessons, and I don't like some of the homework. But it was absolutely necessary for me to go through all of those experiences that I went through. And I sincerely believe what I told Caroline there, that it was necessary for me to have an alcoholic in my life to learn to love. I thought I knew something about love, but it was not until I came into the Al-Anon program that I really understood what love really is. Before that, I thought it was something possession. The love was always with strings attached to it. And it wasn't until I came into Al-Anon that I'm slowly learning how to love with those strings attached. So this is why it's necessary for me to have had an alcoholic in my life. I always like to point out, too, that I did not say that we've been married now a little over 44 years, and that's a miracle. Goldine talked about how it being a sin in Southern California to be married that long. I didn't stay because I was noble. I stayed because I was a coward. It was through my inventory understanding of through the Al-Anon program that I came to clarify that within my mind, because I came from a broken home. And I remember when I was a teenager, I used to always pray to a God I didn't understand or believe in. This was a wrathful God, and a God that judged and condemned and all of this stuff. And I was on the wrong side of the ledger column, you know. But I would say almost nightly a prayer that our family would get back together, and it was never gotten back together. From that, I realized prayers were not answered, particularly mine. Maybe God worked in other people's lives, but not mine. And somewhere or other, I instilled within myself that we were not going to have a marriage, that I was not going to have a marriage like my parents. Now, this was this subconscious kind of a realization. And so all of my life, I protected Goldine from her alcoholism. As far as I know, I never criticized her from another human being until I came into Al-Anon. Because to do so would indicate to them that we didn't have this happy marriage. So I was wearing this mask. So all of our infighting was in the house, you see. Outwardly, in a social setting, I could be the perfect gentleman, but get me out of that, and we were alone in the car, things like that, then I'd really light into her. There's a promise in the 12 steps. I believe in the 12 steps. I believe that the program begins with the 12 steps. I happen to believe that the 12 steps are not recovery. I think it's the beginning of recovery. I think that service is recovery. I think that the 12 steps gets us into service so we can experience the traditions and experience the concepts. And I think that's where the recovery is. If you go back and look at our logos in both AA and Al-Anon, you'll see that very simply in the triangle. But without the triangle, you can't ever find the circle. So you can't just work the steps. But I came to believe that there was a promise in the 12th step. And there's only one promise in those 12 steps. And the promise is in the 12th step where it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say anything about it will happen if you work the first three steps on a daily basis. It doesn't say it will work if you work the first and the 12th step. It says if you work those steps, something will happen. There will be a spiritual awakening. It doesn't say it might happen. It says that it will happen. In the AA Big Book, it points out the result of working the 12 steps is the 12 promises. A person pointed out to me, if you haven't experienced the 12 promises, go back and work some more of the steps some more. See? But anyway, when I came to that realization, I was going to a step study meeting and had been for quite a number of years, and coming to that 12th step, I kept saying, what's this spiritual awakening that I'm supposed to experience? Because there have been no flashes. I've not had the zapping experience that Bill W. had. Burning bushes never talked to me. I never heard booming voices. Nothing like this ever happened to me, you know. But I came to realize one time in meditating that something hit me. And it's down here in my gut. It wasn't up here in my head. It's down here in my gut. And those of you who have had this gut feeling going on, I'm talking about those who are still up in the head trip don't understand what I'm saying because it sounds so simple, and that's what this program is. It's so simple. The realization I had is that everything's okay. That's my bottom line. Regardless of what's going taking place, everything's okay. I may not like it, but it's okay. In looking at my life, the only great things that have ever happened to me and turnarounds in my life has come from pain, emotional, physical, or mental pain. I've only changed myself when I have become uncomfortable. So my uncomfortableness, my pain, is the thing that's my directing force. And everything has always been okay. The greatest defect I ever had, my wife, now the greatest asset I have. You see, and this is a turnaround. I was at a convention a number of years ago down in Louisiana, and I was having breakfast with a person, a woman, and she was sitting there with her elbow on the table holding this piece of toast and telling me all of her problems. And she had the normal run of problems, and I don't know whether you like it or notice it or not, but we always like problems, huh? You know, we get attention when we talk about problems, don't we? People sit on the edge of their chair wondering how it's going to all turn out and everything. And then we get into competition with problems. You know, my problem's bigger than your problem, you know. You think that was bad for you. Listen to what I have to say. So we like to talk about our problems. And once in a while, problems will take a run. And this is what happened to that woman. She was kind of getting excited about her problems, and then she started projecting her problems. And, you know, my God, 6 months from now, this might happen. And 9 months from now, I might have to do this and this. And finally, she just blurted out, she said, Bob, what should I do? And with no hesitation, I said, why don't you eat your toast? That was the most profound truth that ever come out of my mouth. And it was not I thought. It was my words, you see. Because if we would stop taking problems, which are merely experiences, and putting labels on our experiences, and thinking about those experiences, and instead of going on to our next experience, did you know we wouldn't have any problems? A lot of times people call me with these problems. I said, hey, what problem did you have last year? Well, what do you mean? I said, well, you had as many problems last year as you had this year. What were they last year? Well, I don't remember. You see, this is what happens to problems. And if we would just go from moment to moment to moment, we wouldn't have problems. My problems always exist up here. Always exist up there. And if I would just go along with life, it seems that it becomes all okay. And that's the okayness of what this program is. And what the okayness was caused by was trying to come back and live in the now. Right this moment, everything's okay. Right this moment, I see a bunch of beautiful people out here. You see? Right this moment, everything's okay with everybody in this room. Right this moment. But when you start thinking, you know, what are you going to do tomorrow morning? How about next month? You know, remember last night. You know, when this and this, then we start having problems. And being in the now is becomes the answer. I found out in Al-Anon as a human being. I knew it. I could answer the question always on quizzes in school that I was a human being. But I knew it up here. But I lived my life as a human has been or a human will be. That, you know, always in the past with all of the regrets and the why did I do that and the guilt and the resentments, or always in the future of, my God, what's going to happen now? You know, never coming back to right this moment where it's all okay. So that's what the program is. And I think the Deep last night explained it so well. The thing that makes it all okay is that thing which you find in this program called love. I found that the only defect of characters that I have, basically, is really my inability to love. Inability to love myself, inability to love others, and inability to love God and life. And I can eliminate all my emotional uncomfortableness at any given moment, if I choose to, by coming back to finding out what is it I am not loving and learn to love that. And that becomes the answer. You see, we talk about living in the now, we talk about the presence with a capital P, and that's all it is. I had an interesting experience. Don't try to analyze this one here, but just take it home and let it set sometime. Jolene sponsored a crazy little girl, just a delight, you know, lovable little girl that was just kind of a rattle brain. And she came to Al-Anon too because she'd been married 7 times, and Goldie made her stay in a relationship. But anyway, she would call, and we would get into these profound, deep discussions about spirituality and God. And one time the phone rang, and the first words that came over, she says, "Hi, God, this is God." And I kind of shook my head, and I said, "Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's all this program is. It's the God in me trying to talk to the God in you, and the God in you trying to talk to the God in me. God talking himself through us." I always like to point out that that can be the greatest ego trip that anybody ever gets on, or it can be the greatest point of humility that one can ever have. So don't try to understand it, but just think about maybe all this is God talking to God. Last fall, I want to write a book. The book's up here. And I realized God can't type. You see, God can give me the thoughts, but I have to do the footwork. And that's what the program is. God can give me the message, but I have to carry it out. If I'm sitting there on the front porch in my rocking chair thinking God's going to look after me, I'll starve to death. But God will give me all of the opportunities. But getting back to what took place in our life, we started out on the drinking trail when we were first married. And I was in the service and had every eighth day off, and every eighth day we'd buy a bottle and we'd go out and dance and have fun. And no big deals, except every once in a while she wouldn't be the lady. So I would have to caution her. Now, I would sometimes do this verbally, sometimes with my elbow, sometimes I'd have to pinch her. I remember one time I hit her, and it was all for her good, to bring her back into being a lady. Now, in the AA Big Book, they talk about crossing the invisible line from social drinking to alcoholic drinking, and I think I crossed an invisible line into Al-Anonism. Because there was some point when she stopped minding me. And that's when I had to go to all of those extremes that we go to try to outwit them. And this was the name of the game for many, many years. I was a very, very angry person. And always have been angry. And I think that alcoholism was the catalyst that brought that out then. And I would constantly get angry and mad at what she was doing, you know. And we would I'd have these angry outbursts, and lots of times we'd get into these, what they call them, meaningful discussions. Where I would have to have the last word and prove myself right, or maybe she'd have to prove herself right, and there's only one way that could go, and that was into this violent argument. There was one incident when we were living in Long Beach at the time, and on Friday nights we used to like to go up to a little place up in the corner where they had steaks and a cocktail place, and found out that every Friday night was exactly the same. We would go up there, have a couple of martinis, eat dinner, and end up in the bar having an after dinner drink or so, and at 2 o'clock in the morning we'd be fighting with one another, and the bartender said the bar is closing, you have to go home. And the next morning I looked in the billfold and most of the paycheck was gone. And one night I said, we're not going to do that anymore. And Goldine says, well, let's go up there and have one drink and eat dinner and come home. And that made sense to me. So we went up there and had the vodka martini, and then they brought the Roquefort salad, and I was watching her, and it was all over her face and all over her blouse and all over the table. And I thought, how on one martini could she do that, you know? And then after dinner, she says, let's have one after dinner drink. And that sounded reasonable. Well, at 2 o'clock, we were fighting, and the bartender was telling us the bar was closing. And I couldn't understand how that happened. And it was about that time, whether I was looking for it or not, I don't know, but I ran across a hidden bottle. And I was furious. And I brought this bottle out, and I started asking those Al-Anon questions. Why do you do it? And I kept getting those alcoholic answers. I don't know. And I'd say, you do too know. And she says, I don't know. And this would start our meaningful discussion. She was telling me the truth. She didn't know at that time she was an alcoholic. She didn't know why she did it, but it was totally unacceptable. And this oftentimes led to the extremes of my anger, which was, if you're going to be like that, then get out. And she'd go get in the car and drive around the block and promise not to do those things anymore, and we'd kiss and make up and going to live happily ever after next week, next month. Get out. And if she was gone too long, I'd get in the other car and go try to find out where she was. The other extreme was that I would punish her. I wouldn't speak to her. And we could go days at a time not speaking to one another. You know, neither one of us was very prone in making up. So when you have a household like that, you have a lot of silence. And you know, we'd go down the hall and bump shoulders and wouldn't say a word one to one another. Sometimes Goldine says those are the happiest days of her life. But this was the anger that was coming out within myself, and it was being expressed against our children, against my wife, and I was constantly in a turmoil. Stomach's churning all of the time. I ended up being a hunter of bottles. I don't know whether anybody else has had that pleasure. But I had a college degree, and I knew how smart I was. You could find me crawling around on my hands and knees, looking under the bed and in the dresser drawers, and One time I mentioned in a meeting I'd found the bottle in the bottom of the 5-pound box of soap. And somebody said, why did you look there? And I said, well, there wasn't any other place it could be. So I was a pretty thorough hunter. She's a pretty good hider also. And if I found that bottle, I'd get mad. And if I couldn't find that bottle, I'd drive me up the wall. You know? I ultimately, and every time I declare myself the winner, I bring it out, declare myself a winner, see? And after a while, apparently I wasn't getting the response, so I left, I'd find the bottle, leave it there, and put a little mark. And come home that night, put a little mark, so I could tell. See, I was her husband, I should know these things, you know. And I always like in a room, like to find out, are there any other markers in the room? Okay, you understand. The others don't understand, right? They've never had the experience. But this is the ultimate, you know. But this would always start these arguments, and things kept getting worse and worse and worse. After a while, I remember one time Goldine thought she might be an alcoholic, and said, and so she asked me my opinion. And I said, honestly, I said, don't drink so much. You see? Don't drink so much. I could do that. See, I didn't have the allergy. I probably had the obsession. I probably drank for the same reason. But I could drink half a glass and put it away. I used to buy a bottle hoping that it might last us for a couple of weeks. And I couldn't understand how she would, and this fellow next door, they always had to finish it. You know, can't you save something for next week? You know? This I didn't understand. And Al-Anon taught me something. And the principle of Al-Anon is not understanding. The principle of Al-Anon is acceptance. I think acceptance is a spiritual act. Understanding is an intellectual act. And this is not an intellectual program. It's a spiritual program. See, to accept without understanding. I was brought up, don't ever accept anything unless you understand it. You know? All my schooling was on that area. Don't accept it until you understand it. And so all this intellectual jargon trying to understand certain things. And Al-Anon says, hey, you don't have to understand it at all. Accept it. Accept it. So I now still do not understand why an alcoholic drinks once they find out they're an alcoholic. I cannot comprehend it. Goldie knows why. My job is to accept it, not to understand it. I missed that one time at a convention. A person came up, an alcoholic, and said, well, let me help you to understand why an alcoholic drinks. I said, you don't understand what I'm trying to say. No explanation from you can make me understand. Because all of your explanation will lodge in my head and not come down here in the gut. I may intellectually understand, but to know, it has to go from my head down here through my experience. And I'm not an alcoholic, so I cannot experience alcoholism. And it's the same way with this whole program. I cannot understand anything or really the essence of it unless I have experienced it. So this is not an intellectual thing. I can read all the literature that's ever been published on Al-Anon. I can read all the literature on alcoholism, and I will know absolutely nothing except up here. What I have to do is experience it. And that's what this program is. The only thing I really know is that which I've experienced. The rest of it is that which I think I know. You see. So Al-Anon then is an experiencing program. Goldine, one time, with this fellow next door down in Long Beach, he had gotten on the AA program, and Goldine thought that maybe she should start going to AA. And she started going to this fellow next door. Now, he's a friend of mine, has been for 35, 40 years. But he wasn't that much of a friend where he could be taking my wife out at night, you know. So they would go to these meetings, and I remember one time I said, I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic. I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic. And this is my determination. And I didn't support her any in her program. And she says in her story that she was not trying to find sobriety. She was trying to find a way to control her drinking. I didn't give her any support because, first of all, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about AA except that they were a bunch of gutter drunks. And I was not going to let my wife be that. And so nothing happened, but this started her going in and out of AA that lasted about 2.5 years. Things kept getting worse in my work. I was dealing with the public, and I was this angry person that was lashing out at people that I was dealing with in business, and they were calling back to my employer, calling the accounts that we had, and you know, I could be driving down the road wondering what she's doing, and this is what alcoholism is. This is what the obsession does to the family. totally locked in mentally with what the alcoholic's doing. And as a result of that, my life was becoming very, very chaotic, and I was about ready to quit a job I had been at for quite a number of years. I was working for a two-man partnership. I was the third man. And one of the partners found out that I was thinking about leaving, and he said, well, where do you want to go? And that's how I got to Riverside. I've come to believe that every experience that I experience is a spiritual experience. Nothing happens in my life by accident. I just don't understand it maybe at the time it occurs. I may not understand why I'm here right this moment. I may not understand that for 20, 30, 40 years, or maybe I will the next day, tomorrow morning, I don't know. But it's not by accident that I happen to be here. And so it is, it was not by accident that we moved to Riverside and this former employer of mine, Grubstake, just to go out there. Why he did it, I'll never know. But it's part of my life. Something very interesting happened before we moved to Riverside. I had about 3 or 4 months notice before moving to Riverside, and Goldeen said, leave me alone, get off my back, and when we get to Riverside, I'll stop drinking. And to this date, I don't remember too much about what happened during those 3 or 4 months. And a number of years after I was in Al-Anon, I got to thinking, why is it that we in Al-Anon believe the promise of the alcoholic? The alcoholic, I'm sure, is sincere in the making of their promise. But due to the nature of the illness, they can't keep the promise. But why do we in Al-Anon continue to believe, have the promise broken, they'll re-promise, we will re-believe? And I came to see that for me, I had to believe in something for the basis of my happiness. And the basis of my happiness was a successful marriage. I had no concept of a God to believe in that was any higher than that. And therefore, regardless of how many times she disappointed me and broke the promise, I had to come back to that belief. We cannot go through life without a belief system of some kind. And this, of course, is what the alcoholic is. I'm sure believing that alcoholism is going to do for them, that's their greatest belief system. And this is why in our programs, I think, that we replace that with a spiritual basis, a spiritual belief, which is then dependable, non-changing, and something that's higher and totally dependable. So, but for me, I realized that's what I was believing, that Goldeen would change when we got to Riverside. We got out to Riverside, she didn't drink for a day or so, and right back to the old pattern. Nothing had changed except the hiding places. After about a few months, she started going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And some way or other, some people came up and talked to her, and they talked to me, and I started going to AA speaker meetings with her. And boy, could I identify between that speaker and her. And when something really important came up, I'd nudge her. And going home, I'd go through that speaker's whole talk, pulling out all those important points that she should remember. And she'd sit in the corner of the car there and just give me this go-to-hell type look. And the next day she'd buy a bottle. I couldn't understand that. The next day she'd be drunk. I couldn't understand it. See, I was trying to help her. This went on for quite a while. And after about a year, I bought out the interest of that business and decided that to cut down on expenses, to build an office onto the home. And Goldeen says, well, you know, the reason that she drank is she never had any responsibility. She'd always been a housewife for 20-some years. Always. And that made sense. So we put her on as a secretary, and all we got out of that was a drunken secretary. She had her own paycheck. I did not count for it. I was gone most of the time. I'd come home night after night, and there she was, passed out in the chair. You know, that didn't work. I had an experience. Our daughter was 16. We had 3 children. The oldest is daughter, and at that time she was 16. She wasn't minding me. And so I had to put some sense into her, and I put the pressure on her. I said, Barb, you start minding me, you're going to have to get out. And the first thing I see, you're packing a little grip. And I knew she, in my smugness, see, this is the bad thing about self-righteousness, you know. We can't see anything if we're covered with self-righteousness, and this was me. I knew that she couldn't get along without me and my support. I knew she'd be back. She walked out of the house. She didn't come back for a while. I thought, well, fine, I better go find that kid, put some sense into her. So I went looking for Barb, and I found her in a phone booth down by the freeway. And I went up to her, and I said, Barb, you start minding, and you can come back. And she looked me right square in the eye, and she said, Dad, I'm not coming back. I could not take any responsibility for that at all. And this is what self-righteousness and arrogance, which I was full of, will do. I could not take any blame at all or any sense of responsibility. It was she. That was, I was trying to make her into a lady, and she wasn't minding me. I remember I left her there. I didn't have the courage to say I was sorry. I don't even know whether I felt sorry. I don't think so. All I knew is that our life was falling apart. I still feel the feeling today as I drove back home, that the wife is drunk most of the time, the daughter running away, and everything that we tried to build up in our home for 20-some years is going down the rat hole. And I didn't understand it, but it was not my fault at all, you see. I like to talk about Barb once in a while because she went down to San Pedro, stayed with friends, graduated from high school. By this time I was in the program. I had made amends to her. We had a good conversation and cleared the air and everything. But Barb married a young man who drank a little bit, and sure enough, he's had the problem, alcoholism. Everybody thinks he is except him. For years, we kept talking to Barb, why don't you go to Al-Anon? Why don't you go to Al-Anon? No, she didn't need Al-Anon. And after about 10 years of marriage, some violence started. And she called one night and said, Dad, can I come home? And I said, I'm sorry, Barb, you can't come home. I recognized where she was coming from. I said, you can come home to visit, but you can't come home to stay, because I recognized she was trying to run from alcoholism again. She had run from alcoholism in the home. She didn't have benefit of Al-Anon. So she ran, and she ran right back into alcoholism, and then she wanted to run again, and I put a stop to it. And fortunately, she started going to Al-Anon. When she ran away from home, she had absolutely no self-worth, she had absolutely no belief in any kind of a higher power. After going to Al-Anon, she got this self-worth and a belief in a higher power. And momentarily, things started straightening out, and then she started going to church thinking she'd get from that, and dropped Al-Anon, and unfortunately, it reverted to the other, and the marriage ended in a divorce. But I think the principle involved in that is that we cannot run from anything. We talk about alcoholism being a spiritual illness. Have you ever thought that it is something that God gives to us for our benefit to work through rather than to run from? It's a spiritual illness, I think. This is a spiritual program. Not an intellectual program, it's not a behavioral program, it's not a psychological program, it's a spiritual program, I believe, that some way or other, to make contact with that spiritual energy and that higher power or whatever it is, to transcend all of this stuff has been the problem down here in our lives. Things kept getting worse in our household, and one night Goldine did something which hurt the male ego. I was standing over Goldine, trying to figure out what should I do. Should I kill her? Should I kill myself? Or kill both of us? And I was trying to find out some way that I might do away with her and not get caught, you know. I find, for me, that when I have crazy thoughts, God gives me a crazier thought to keep me from doing it. Because the reason I didn't do it is, what would the neighbors think? You know, that obviously they would know that ours is not a happy marriage, you know. Another week went by, or another month or so went by, and Goldine did something similar, and this time I told her to get out. And she went down to Long Beach to stay with those friends who had been on the AA program by then. And she got 24 hours of AA through tapes, meetings, and talks. And I was left at home with two small boys, trying to be the mother to them, the father, and the housekeeper, and all of this stuff. Feeling two emotions that some of you might have felt. Feeling absolutely miserable and enjoying every minute of it. That's called the combination of self-pity and martyrdom. Very deadly combination, by the way. And after about a week, Virginia, from the house down there in Long Beach, called and said, "Bob, why don't you come down and see if you can reconcile?" Now, I was never one to be the first to ever straighten up any of our differences here, but here Virginia was asking me. So for Virginia's sake, I went down there. Well, I wanted to go anyway. See, I wanted to straighten this thing out. Not to straighten it out, but to get back together. And I walked in there, and they've written a pamphlet about me. Some of us are arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and domineering. And this is the way I walked in that house, and I said, "Here's in the conditions that you can come back." And Goldine was pretty well beat. She knew she was never going to have another drink, and she would have agreed to anything. But that night, something happened. Virginia said, "Bob, had you ever thought of Al-Anon?" And I didn't know what she was talking about. Consciously, I had not ever heard the word Al-Anon. Undoubtedly, it had been mentioned in AA meetings, but it didn't register up here. I didn't know what it was, except I thought it might be a method that I didn't know about of keeping Goldine sober. So I agreed to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting down in Anaheim, a beginner's meeting. And I walked in there, and they were all women. And I knew they didn't have my problem. You know, I could tell. Some of them had sparkles in their eyes and smiles in their face. And they didn't seem to understand me. You know, I had this wife who wouldn't stop her drinking, and they seemed to indicate that I couldn't stop her. And I knew that I could, I just needed the right technique, you know. And apparently Al-Anon was not it. So I was not impressed with Al-Anon. But on the way home, Virginia said, "Before you make up your mind, try at least 6 or 8 meetings." And I said I would. I'd made a commitment. I was a people pleaser. What would Virginia think of me if I didn't go to those 6 or 8 meetings, you know? So we went back to Riverside. Goldine was never going to drink again. And we were going to live happily ever after. And a couple of days later, there she was, back to her drinking. Same thing. But something had happened, and that was that I started going to Al-Anon. Second meeting I went to, I met the first man in Al-Anon. He said a couple of strange things that didn't make any sense to me. He apparently had not been around for a little while. And people were asking, "How are you? And how's things? And how's the wife?" And he says, "Well, you know, she hasn't had a drink for 6 months. And I thought, "Well, what's he doing here? If his wife is not drinking, why is he here?" And then he said the strangest thing. He said that people at work were bugging him. He had to come back to find some serenity. I didn't know what he's talking about. But this is the way my program works and how my higher power works. I would think of those things, what the devil's he talking about? You know, these crazy things that we hear in this program. Didn't make any sense to me, but if I thought about them long enough, I'd have what's called the aha experience. You ever had that? I understand, right. If you don't think you've had the aha experience, go back and read some of your literature again in your books. You'll see it's been revised since the last time you read it. There are brand new thoughts in there that weren't there before. If you're an outliner and an underliner, you'll find that, why did I underline that when this next sentence is much more profound and more important? You know? And I think that this is what this program is, a constant increase in our aha and our awareness. See, when people come in, if they're newcomers here, I'm sure the judgment is, what the hell is that crazy guy talking about up there? My husband's home is passed out on the Davenport. What's this got to do with that, you know? But that's our whole program, is to have this aha experience. Bill Wilson had a great big instantaneous one. And ours, I think, are in smaller increments. I find that those steps are constantly being revised for me. I don't know about you. But I was in the program 7 years, going to a step study group. And on the third step, I kept saying, how do I turn my life and will over to the care of God? And it took me 7 years to see a word there that had just been put in there for me that I'd never seen before. And that is, it says, make a decision. I don't have to know how to turn my life and will over the care of God. That's God's business, not mine. All I have to do is make the decision. And I found out that the way that is done is not through the third step, but through the 11th step. Oh, I was 7 years in the program. I was 15 years in the program when I saw a revision of that 11th step. I had always quoted it as increase my conscious contact with God. And it suddenly dawned on me the word is improve. Quality, not quantity. By that time, or sometime between, up until that time, I had learned meditation. And gee, I could be in the state of euphoria in certain structured meditation, and I was in that for up to an hour and a half. And I got to be thinking I was pretty spiritual until I realized I was trying to keep from going to work. So I'd stay in meditation, keep from going to work, right? So after that, I learned that my meditation is for 5 or 10 minutes of quality time, not quantity time. So I'm still learning. You know, after all these years, I'm still finding new thoughts, new ideas in this whole program here. Another thing that I came to realize that I felt better if I went to an Al-Anon meeting. And the next day seemed to be a bit better. And I'm always reminded of a woman out of Riverside who was one of these bitter ones that you don't see too many of them around anymore, but she was bitter. And I bet she hadn't smiled for years. And after about 5 or 6 meetings, she came up to me and she said, "Bob, this program may work for you, it may work for others, but it doesn't work for me." I said, "Well, how come you keep coming back?" "Because I feel better." That's our program. That's our program. I had certain lots of early experiences in the Al-Anon program, and I think I had a crash course. I think I was ready for it, although I didn't realize I was ready for it. But I was around, and I use that word deliberately. People can be in this room for 2 different reasons. To be around the program or in the program. If you're around the program, you're thinking, hoping that something will change outwardly there, so that you don't come here anymore. And you see people who are around the program that when that changes, they leave. If you're in the program, you find the purpose of it is to change yourself. And therefore, you stay around. And I was around the program hoping she would get sober, you see. I was not in the program. But I was around the program for about 6 weeks when I felt absolutely miserable. And doing a little head trip here, I realized Al-Anon had made me miserable. Al-Anon had made me aware of my feelings. And I was feeling absolutely miserable. The way I like to put it is when you're miserable and don't know you're miserable, you're not nearly as miserable as when you're miserable and you know you're miserable. This is what happens to the alcoholic when they find out about their drinking. You know, never comfortable with another drink. You see, same way with lifestyle program is not a behavioral program. It's not a psychological program. It's a spiritual program, I believe, that some way or other, to make contact with that spiritual energy and that higher power or whatever it is, to transcend all of this stuff that's been the problem down here in our lives. Things kept getting worse in our household, and one night Goldine did something which hurt the male ego. I was standing over Goldine, trying to figure out what should I do. Should I kill her, should I kill myself, or kill both of us? And I was trying to find out some way that I might do away with her and not get caught, you know. I find, for me, that when I have crazy thoughts, God gives me a crazier thought to keep me from doing it. Because the reason I didn't do it is, what would the neighbors think, you know? That obviously they would know that ours is not a happy marriage, you know. Another week went by, or another month or so went by, and Goldine did something similar, and this time I told her to get out. And she went down to Long Beach to stay with those friends who had been on the AA program by then. And she got 24 hours of AA through tapes, meetings, and talks. And I was left at home with two small boys, trying to be the mother to them, the father, and the housekeeper, and all of this stuff. Feeling two emotions that some of you might have felt. Feeling absolutely miserable and enjoying every minute of it. That's called the combination of self-pity and martyrdom. Very deadly combination, by the way. And after about a week, Virginia, from the house down there in Long Beach, called and said, "Bob, why don't you come down and see if you can reconcile?" Now, I was never one to be the first to ever straighten up any of our differences here, but here Virginia was asking me. So for Virginia's sake, I went down there. Well, I wanted to go anyway. See, I wanted to straighten this thing out. Not to straighten it out, but to get back together. And I walked in there, and they'd written a pamphlet about me. Some of us are arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and domineering. And this is the way I walked in that house, and I said, "Here's in the conditions that you can come back." And Goldine was pretty well beat. She knew she was never going to have another drink, and she would have agreed to anything. But that night, something happened. Virginia said, "Bob, had you ever thought of Al-Anon?" And I didn't know what she was talking about. Consciously, I had not ever heard the word Al-Anon. Undoubtedly, it had been mentioned in AA meetings, but it didn't register up here. I didn't know what it was, except I thought it might be a method that I didn't know about of keeping Goldine sober. So I agreed to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting down in Anaheim. It was a beginner's meeting. And I walked in there, and they were all women. And I knew they didn't have my problem. You know, I could tell some of them had sparkles in their eyes and smiles on their face. And they didn't seem to understand me. You know, I had this wife who wouldn't stop her drinking, and they seemed to indicate that I couldn't stop her. And I knew that I could, I just needed the right technique. You know, and apparently Al-Anon was not it. So I was not impressed with Al-Anon. But on the way home, Virginia said, "Before you make up your mind, try at least 6 or 8 meetings." And I said I would. I made a commitment. I was a people pleaser. What would Virginia think of me if I didn't go to those 6 or 8 meetings, you know? So we went back to Riverside. Goldine was never going to drink again. And we were going to live happily ever after. And a couple of days later, there she was, back to her drinking. Same thing. But something had happened, and that was that I'd started going to Al-Anon. Second meeting I went to, I met the first man in Al-Anon. He said a couple of strange things that didn't make any sense to me. He apparently had not been around for a little while. And people ask me, "How are you? And how's things? And how's the wife?" And he says, "Well, you know, she hasn't had a drink for 6 months. And I thought, "Well, what's he doing here? If his wife is not drinking, why is he here?" And then he said the strangest thing. He said that people at work were bugging him. He had to come back to find some serenity. I didn't know what he's talking about. But that's the way my program works and how my higher power works. I would think of those things, what the devil's he talking about? You know, these crazy things that we hear in this program. Didn't make any sense to me, but if I thought about them long enough, I'd have what's called the aha experience. You ever had that? I understand, right. If you don't think you've had the aha experience, go back and read some of your literature again, your books. You'll see it's been revised since the last time you read it. There are brand new thoughts in there that weren't there before. If you're an outliner and an underliner, you'll find that, why did I underline that when this next sentence is much more profound and more important? You know? And I think that this is what this program is, a constant increase in our aha and our awareness. See, when people come in, If there are newcomers here, I'm sure the judgment is, what the hell is that crazy guy talking about up there? My husband's home passed out on the Davenport. What's this got to do with that, you know? But that's our whole program, is to have this aha experience. Bill Wilson had a great big instantaneous one, and ours, I think, are in smaller increments. I find that those steps are constantly being revised for me. I don't know about you, but I was in the program 7 years, going to a step study group, and on the third step, I kept saying, how do I turn my life and will over the care of God? And it took me 7 years to see a word there that had just been put in there for me that I'd never seen before. And that is, it says, make a decision. I don't have to know how to turn my life and will over the care of God. That's God's business, not mine. All I have to do is make the decision. And I found out that the way that is done is not to the third step, but to the 11th step. Oh, I was 7 years in the program. I was 15 years in the program when I saw a revision of that 11th step. I had always quoted it as increase my conscious contact with God. And it suddenly dawned on me the word is improve. Quality, not quantity. By that time, or sometime between, up until that time, I had learned meditation. And gee, I could be in the state of euphoria in certain structured meditation, and I was in that for up to an hour and a half. And I got to be thinking I was pretty spiritual until I realized I was trying to keep from going to work. So I'd stay in meditation, keep from going to work, right? So after that, I learned that my meditation is for 5 or 10 minutes of quality time, not quantity time. So I'm still learning. You know, after all these years, I'm still finding new thoughts, new ideas in this whole program here. Another thing that I came to realize that I felt better if I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and the next day seemed to be a bit better. And I'm always reminded of a woman out in Riverside who was one of these bitter ones. That you don't see too many of them around anymore, but she was bitter. And I bet she hadn't smiled for years. And after about 5 or 6 meetings, she came up to me and she said, Bob, this program may work for you, it may work for others, but it isn't going to work for me. I said, well, how come you keep coming back? Because I feel better. That's our program. That's our program. I had lots of early experiences in the Al-Anon program, and I think I had a crash course. I think I was ready for it, although I didn't realize I was ready for it. But I was around, and I use that word deliberately. People can be in this room for 2 different reasons. To be around the program or in the program. If you're around the program, you're thinking, hoping that something will change outwardly there, so that you don't come here anymore. And you see people who are around the program that when that changes, they leave. If you're in the program, you find the purpose of it is to change yourself. And therefore, you stay around. And I was around the program hoping she would get sober, you see. I was not in the program. But I was around the program for about 6 weeks when I felt absolutely miserable. And doing a little head trip here, I realized Al-Anon had made me miserable. Al-Anon had made me aware of my feelings. And I was feeling absolutely miserable. The way I like to put it is when you're miserable and don't know you're miserable, you're not nearly as miserable as when you're miserable and you know you're miserable. That's what happens to the alcoholic when they find out about their drinking. You know, never comfortable with another drink. You see, same way with Al-Anon. Al-Anon made me aware. And every time I started talking about her, they'd take that finger and turn it around at me. And I didn't like that. It made me angry. So I had to express my anger. And at an Al-Anon meeting, I went to an Al-Anon meeting one night, and I told them what I thought of. And I spent about half that meeting telling them all. And they just sat there, and they smiled at me. And I finally ran down after about half that meeting, and a woman sent by from Seattle changed my life. Looked me right square in the eye, and she says, Bob, you know now. And you have a choice. You can be miserable, and you can work this program. I didn't like what she said. I've never forgotten it. The choice is mine. I can be miserable or I can work this program. That is when I became a member of Al-Anon, because I didn't want to be miserable any longer. Now, I'm not trying to say I had a great big instantaneous aha experience and everything is okay. I don't mean. But what happened is my direction changed. I stopped arguing. I started trying to listen a little bit. I started trying to get over what's called ego sclerosis. I started trying to look at myself. You see, I'd done a lot of things that I was ashamed of and wish I hadn't done, but it was all her fault. You see, people made me angry. I still hear that, you know, of righteous anger. There is no such thing. The result is the same. I could always put my behavior in terms of somebody else as causing me to do it. And what happened is that I broke finally through self-righteousness. And it's surprising. You see, I think self-righteousness is the veil that kept me from seeing other defects of character. And when I broke that, it was surprising how many defects Al-Anon gave me in a very short period of time. Sometimes people say, "Jen, I don't know what to put down in my inventory." I say, "Why don't you start with self-righteousness?" But it's a great hindrance to our progress, and I think that before we can get any place, we have to break through that. The first defect of character I recognized within myself was that of anger. And I was a very, very angry person. Almost every day I was full of anger and expressing anger. Not so much physically as verbally and inside. I always had this tight knot in my stomach. And I heard people talking about let go, let die. And these were people with smiles on their face and sparkles in their eyes. And they had something that I didn't have. I didn't understand what they were talking about, but I knew they must have had something. I had an experience. I was sitting in our backyard and things were absolutely miserable. And I yelled out one time, I said, "God help me." And that quick, the first time in my life, I was 42 years of age, I saw an answer to a prayer that I said, the first time I ever saw anything like that happen. And it made me aware that there was something. I didn't know what it was. But I remember, and this was accidental, this was not a deliberate decision, but I remember getting up one morning and said, "God, don't let me be angry today." And that day I was not angry. And I did that again. And I did that for a whole week. For a whole week I was not angry. And that was a miracle in my life. From that time, almost 22 years ago, until now, I am always made aware of when I am getting angry. Before that, I would not know I was getting angry, and I would react, and only after the anger would I say, "There, you did it again. Why did you do it?" You know. But there was no control because I was not aware. Now I'm aware. I have a choice. Very rarely do I get angry anymore. Every once in a while I have what's called refresher courses. To work through, but I always like to talk about a member of AA who I just hated, had no use for him. Whenever we were around one another at a club or something like that, we'd get in an argument. Whenever I thought about John, I would say a little prayer that he'd had a heart attack, and I would say a little prayer hoping that he would have something a little bit more severe. And whenever I thought of John, I'd get this knot in my stomach, I'd feel the old heart going and the blood coursing through my veins. And one time a person said, "Why don't you pray for John?" I said, "Why should I pray for John?" He said, "Well, you like the knot in your stomach?" I said, "No, I don't like the knot in my stomach." He said, "Well, you better pray for John." I said, "I'll be damned if I will." Well, after a while, the knot in my stomach became more unbearable than praying for John. I said, started saying, "God bless that son of a bitch. God bless that son of a bitch." And after a while, the SOB dropped away. I said, "God bless him, God bless him." And you know, John started to change. And one time at a meeting, at a club, I went up to John and said, "John, I sure have to pray a lot for you." And he says, "Bob, I have to pray a lot for you too." But when you start to think about it, all we were doing was making amends and changing our attitude towards the other. Today I love John. I don't see him very often. I haven't seen him in probably 3 or 4 years. But whenever I do, I go up to John and say, "John, I love you." I put my arm around him. John says, "I love you too." You see, a man 100 years ago said, "Love is the essence and beauty is the manifestation. Love is the force, beauty is the result." Love is the force. And we can use love. It's available anytime we wish to by our attitude. You see. Remember, they approached me one time after I told this story at a convention. He came up to me and he said, "Bob, it's all right to be angry as long as you handle it appropriately." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. But isn't it better to have God remove it rather than trying to have to worry how to handle it appropriately?" So many people that I hear on this program say, "I'm working on my defects." The seventh step doesn't say that. It says we humbly ask God to remove our defects. And I find that for me, God brings in experiences in my life for me to work with. These are actually my amends. These are the amend steps, the experiences that I go through. So see, I'm not an angry person that I used to be anymore. I don't have to control my anger because I'm not angry. Therefore, I don't need to control it. And this is what the seventh step will do rather than trying to do it by my willpower. I've discovered there's only two steps in the of the 12 steps that are not my will. And that's the seventh and the 11th step. Those are the two power steps. I find a lot of people so engrossed with this fourth step. See, they have retreats on it, they have step meetings, etc., etc. It does absolutely nothing except make you want to aware of how crazy you are. You see? But unless one takes that seventh step, nothing occurs. So it's the power step of the seventh through the 11th step, I believe, in the 12 steps that makes all the difference in the world. So I found out then that these things that people were saying in Al-Anon worked. Now, I wasn't working it perfectly, don't get me wrong, but it made me aware where the answer was. Now, all this time, Goldine was drinking. And I had memorized the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol. And at a meeting, a newcomer would come in, and I'd explain, you're powerless over alcohol. You can't stop that person from drinking. After the meeting, I'd start thinking, I wonder if Goldine's been drinking today. I wonder how much she's been drinking. And I'd go home, get down on my hands and knees, and find the bottle for another mark. All the time thinking I was working that Al-Anon program. I learned a little technique one time. I found out it was a mental obsession. What's Goldine doing? Where's she at? All that stuff. Is she drinking, drunk, etc. as I was driving on the highway. And I learned to play basketball with the thought. And I would almost visually say, God, take this thought away. I don't want this thought. And it would go away momentarily. Then it would come back. And every time it came back, it was almost like I had that basketball and I threw it away. And it would stay away a little bit longer, a little bit longer. Maybe there was a diversion of thought or something like that. But ultimately, that thought would go away. And I think that this then set me up then for another experience of really taking that first step. And I find that for me, God sets up experiences for me to experience the 12 steps. And the experience that God set up for the first step was we had a place down in Ensenada, Mexico. We used to go down there and do a lot of drinking. And Goldine and I had not had anything to drink for several weeks. And we went down there and went over to see some friends, and they set a drink down in front of her and a drink down in front of me. And up until that time, I would have taken that drink some way or other, saying she's not drinking today, or maybe drank it. Some way or other, I would have kept that away from her. And I wasn't thinking about Al-Anon that evening. And I wasn't thinking about the first step. But something with that capital S made me aware that that was her choice and not mine as to whether she drank that. And I sat back to see what took place. And the best way I can describe it is almost like I was at an athletic event watching two teams play, but really not caring who won, but more interested in the play. In other words, I was not a participant, I was an observer. I was not involved physically, I was not involved emotionally, I was not involved mentally. I was merely watching, I wonder what's going to happen. And I saw Goldine struggle. And she struggled. I could see it on her face. And finally she reached over and she picked up that drink and she drank it. And when she drank that, I felt something physically leave me. It started down here in my gut and it came up. Just, I could still feel it. And I didn't know what that was for several months. And I realized that was when I took the first step. When I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, allowed her the right to drink with no interference. But what happened is I became free of my obsession. No longer did I ever try to stop her from drinking. And things got pretty bad. There was one time, I don't know about you, Al-Anons, but I discovered that the alcoholic intuitively knows the button to push to get a reaction. Have you noticed that? I don't think this is conscious. I think it's subconsciously. They know. I found out we can pull the circuit breaker in the whole panel there if we want. But one night, Goldine wanted to have an argument, and I was trying to read my Al-Anon book, and she was standing there, yuck, 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 pushing all these buttons. And I was trying to read this book, you know, and all it was a mass of black print, and I tried to keep my mouth shut. Al-Anon taught me that we would not have an argument if I kept my mouth shut. Very effective. Draws a lot of blood, but it works. But I was saying, I'm not going to react, I'm not going to react. Read your book, read your book, read your book. And of course, I get nothing out of the book. All I hear is this. And finally, Goldine let go. And she went down to the bedroom. And she came back. And as she went by me, she says, at least I'm going to die beautiful. And I looked over there, and there she was in the negligee. She went out in the kitchen. And I heard her messing around in the medicine cabinet. Oh, my God, she's going to take some pills. She's going to kill herself. This little boy said, read your book, read your book. And finally, she went back down in the bedroom, and all these crazy thoughts going through my mind. My God, she's dying. She's dying. Oh, and this, you know, how our minds work. And finally, had you ever thought, we do not think the thought, we only think about the thought. So here comes the thought. The thought was that people are put in particular places to save human lives, and it stopped. And I remembered the old home remedy. And I got a glass of water, and I got a bar of soap, and I soaked it up real good, and I got a bucket. And I went down to the bedroom, and Goldine was passed out. And I propped her up, and I poured this glass of soapy water down her throat. I put my two fingers in her throat and her head in the bucket. Every time my fingers came out, she said, Bob, I didn't take anything, I didn't take anything. That was the last time she ever threatened suicide. For those of you who intend to go out and drink, that's not in our literature, our Al-Anon literature, so you don't have to worry. But one time at an Al-Anon meeting, I was complaining about this drunken secretary, and a wise Al-Anon said, well, if she was other than your wife, would you keep her? I said, of course not. End of conversation. But not the end of thought. And I gave a lot of thought to that. I realized I could live in this situation. I turned into a workaholic. I was spending as little time as possible at home. Our communication was nil. My thoughts towards her were hate and disgust and all of this. I could live in it, but I started realizing there was more to life than what I was experiencing. So I sat Goldie down one time and I said, I don't care whether you drink, but not in this house. And if you're going to drink, you're going to have to get out. And with that, I fired her from the job. And several days went by before I realized she'd stopped her drinking because she hadn't had a drink since that time. What happened? That'll be 22 years next week. 22 years. What happened spiritually? The words I used were almost the same that I'd used many times before. This time, though, there was a difference. My motive. What was my motive? My motive was not to get her sober. My motive, I didn't care whether she drank. Years later, she says, you know, Bob, half that house was mine. You were taking me out of half my house. And I said, yeah, but God wouldn't let you know at that time that half that house was yours. See, that weekend, she had her surrender. I also went through release that I had let go of her physically, emotionally, mentally. I was kicking her out of the house, not for her, but for me and my peace of mind and the two boys who were left at home. I've come to understand this, that God seems to say to me, Bob, if you want to do it your way, okay. If you want me to do it, okay. But we both can't do it together because you mess things up too much. And this is what release or detachment is to backing away totally from a situation to allow space for this energy or love or higher power, whatever you want to call this thing, to come into the situation, just cause something to happen. Someday you ought to listen to Goldine and tell and let her tell what happened to her at that particular time. Because it's gut to gut rather than head to head. It took me 2 years to understand really what occurred. And after about 2 years, I thought there must be something in religion someplace. And I read the Bible from cover to cover, and I didn't understand 99.9% of it. But I ran across the story of Abraham and his oldest son. And if you remember, the oldest son of Abraham was the apple of his eye and the basis of his happiness. And God said, sacrifice your oldest son for me. And Abraham became willing to do so. Because of his willingness to do so, he didn't have to do so. I read that and I said, that's the key. I had become willing to give up the marriage. I had become willing to swallow my false pride to let neighbors, relatives, and everybody else know that ours was not a successful marriage. I was willing to give up my one priority for what I thought was the basis of my happiness. And instead, I substituted something else without my knowing it, and that was that my peace of mind was more important than the marriage. And what I did then, and I found out, have found out since then, that my peace of mind determines my relationship with God. My emotional comfortableness, my ability to love, like Deke was talking about last night, is my attunement and relationship with God. Therefore, if I put that first in my life, everything else will be given to me. And where the marriage is, I don't know. Today, I think we're going to stay together tonight, aren't we? But it's been going along that way now for 20-some years, you see. And I found out for me then, the basis of my emotional comfortableness is through the Al-Anon program. Therefore, I put Al-Anon first in my life, before my wife, before my marriage. I had to put it before my business, put it before everything in my life, because it is that then that gives me all of the experiences that I need to work through to find this thing called love and peace of mind. And Goldine puts AA first in her life, too. I came to realize a number of years ago, she no longer needs me. She's a very sufficient individual now. She no longer needs me. And I realized, yeah, but Bob, you don't need her to need me. And there was the sickness that we had, this thing called relationship and dependency, that I was going to make her happy and she was going to make me happy. And this is what caused all the problems. And now we have the space. And this is what it's all about. After she got sober, there was that absolute peace and happiness, don't get me wrong. For about 6 months, she was on a dry drunk, and I wish, except, you know, it wasn't this bad when she was drinking. But I had to work on something. We had a marriage that was absolutely at zero. I hated her, but I realized how I was the one that had the knot in my stomach, that I was the one that was hurting from my hate. So I had to say a simple seventh step, take a simple seventh step, and that was, God, teach me to love her as she is. Not as I wanted her, but as she is. And she started to change. I've suggested that to people time and time and time again. They think that what I'm trying to say is that what you're trying to make me do is accept all the defects. I said, no, that is not it. And if I can learn to love a person, that will change them. Some way or other, they will change. And Goldine has turned into a very, very beautiful person that I love very, very much. She's a very important part of my life today. And we have lots of good times. We're apart. And I remember one time I missed a meeting, the beautiful weekend that we had. She was home sewing. I was up backpacking. You see? So we don't have to have that sick relationship, see? So we have a lot of good times. I want to briefly talk about how much time. 10 minutes, okay. About our son. He's my refresher course. Steve started an alcoholic at a very early age, and then he discovered alcohol. And he's a pass-out drinker. And every time, he passes out, his arms go out, he flops down on the bed, eyes open, go up to the ceiling, see the whites of his eyes, and he looks like he's dead. He honestly does. I'd come home at night and go and say, look at your son. I would go in there and I'd give him the lecture series. And I found out I was doing the same thing that I was doing with Goldine, except I became more aware of what I was doing. So I would say, get back in your Al-Anon program, Bob. Get back in your Al-Anon program. And I'd allow it to occur. And then the next time it happened, same thing, over and over again. Steve has been in jail half a dozen times. He's totaled out at least 3 cars that I know of. He's got the disease called alcoholism. And I was trying to fix it. One time I was taking some classes on a church, metaphysical thing, where if I could lock something into my mind as true, then it happened out there. The power of the mind. And I had to, as part of this course of study, as an experiment, use the subject and make something happen. So Steve not had anything to drink for several weeks, but he was absolutely miserable. You know, that's not taking an inventory, that's merely simple observation. I used him as a subject. I realized I didn't have the right to pray for his sobriety. That's his charge, not mine. But I felt I had the right to pray for his peace of mind, because that would put him then in touch with his higher power. So I wrote this out for his peace of mind, and I repeated enough where I locked it into my mind, and I knew that prayer was answered.
And I came home that night and there was Steve. I couldn't understand because I knew that prayer was answered. And the next morning I woke up laughing because I realized Steve was at peace. So I said, God, I started laughing and I said, God, help me to understand. And I picked a book off of the dresser that I hadn't looked at for over a year and I opened it at random. And it said in general terms that now that you messed everything up, why don't you let me do it? I said, okay, God. I had one more experience where I came home where Steve was all bombed out. I walked in and I sat down on the bed and I took his hand. I said, Steve, how you doing? Because I had come to a great realization. I was about 15 years in the program. Do you know that what that realization was? That alcoholism is an illness. 15 years in the program. For 15 years, I've been giving public information talks to everybody, newcomers, etc. That alcoholism is an illness. I didn't know it until that night because it went from the intellect down here. I realized Steve suffers from an illness called alcoholism, and there's nothing that I can do about it. And that was the last time his drinking bothered me. Goldine's experience taught me I was powerless over alcohol. But all of those years, in early Al-Anon, I had never accepted the fact that she suffered from alcoholism. I knew I was powerless over alcohol insofar as Goldine was concerned. It took my son to teach me that alcoholism is an illness. Steve has had to go through a lot of experiences. We had to ask him to leave the house. One time he was in jail, and he called and said, Dad, would you bail me out? I said, I'm sorry, Steve, you got yourself here. You're going to have to get yourself out. But he said, Dad, I'll lose my job and this and that. And I said, well, you should have thought about that before. And as I hung up, I said, Steve, I love you. And he said, you don't love me. And he's trying to put the guilt on me because, see, I know that I love him. But there's nothing I can do. He suffers from a disease called alcoholism that I have no control of. I cannot help my own son except not to try to help him. He's got a fabulous story about how he got out of that situation. You know, he's got a fabulous higher power working for him. About a little over three years ago, Steve had some warrants out for his arrest. He had some financial problems. So, like a true alcoholic, he disappeared. And he was gone about 2.5 years. We did not hear word one from him, didn't know whether he was dead or alive. And last fall, shortly before Christmas, I got to wondering about Steve and, Bob, if you'd been a better father. And then I started reading, yeah, but you were the best you were able to be at the time with the knowledge you had. I mean, I had to work through the guilt. And I never got up many mornings and said, I think I'll be a bad father today. Did anybody else ever do that? I never got up and said, I think I'll be a bad husband today. I was always trying to do the best I could with what I knew, which was not very much at the time. And now on, if I had to go through this whole thing again, naturally I would do things differently. But last fall, I said, God, help me know how he is. For my peace of mind. About 2 weeks later, here comes the letter from Steve. First we had heard from him 2.5 years. He made an amend to Goldane, he made an amend to me, and then he said, I'm alive and well. What was my prayer? God, how is Steve? Alive and well. We reestablished some communication. Steve recognized he's kind of made a shambles of his life the last 5 or 6 years. My biggest job is to stay out of all this sage advice and allow him to work his life the way that he feels that he should. You see. I always like to close the story with a talk with a couple of years after. This is Val Goldine, of course. A couple of years after sobriety, I realized she had never made amends to me. I don't know how you guys in AA work it, but in Al-Anon, we always have the alcoholic number one and number two. And then I thought, you know, how could she be sober? How could she be comfortable without making those amends? Shouldn't I be on the top of the list, you know? And then I thought, you know, Bob, you work your program, let her work her program. So I let it go. And a couple more years went by. And one time I walked into the kitchen, she was reading AA Grapevine. And as I went by, she looked up and she said, Bob, have I ever made amends to you? And I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. I knew how important this was, how long it would take. I said to myself, keep your mouth shut. I took a good wide stance, folded my arms, backed up against the counter, and I said, no, you never did. She says, well, I'm sorry. She went back reading the book. I discovered not too many months ago that our obsession is also our ego deflator. See, alcohol will deflate the ego of the alcoholic, and the alcoholic will deflate the ego of the Al-Anon. You better believe it. But she says, well, the greatest amends she can ever make is to be the best member of AA that she could possibly be, and I think that this is true with me also. The greatest amends I can make is not to say I'm sorry. That's usually trying to get somebody off my back or trying to get a response. The greatest amends I can ever make is to try to be the best member of Al-Anon that I can be, to change my behavior, to change my feeling, and change my thinking to the highest as possible with this program of the power within the program. To change me from what I used to be, which is a monster, to something that might be usable. And I think that Chuck C. used to say this, that the whole program is merely trying to set the record straight. Within each of us are some talents that are unused for making this a better world. And I was thinking not too long ago, why didn't they put the 11th step up to number 1 or 2? Because the 11th step has got the power, knowledge and the power. And I realized that we would mishandle it if we didn't first of all go through the 4th through the 10th step. If we did not first of all straighten out the wreckage of the past to make us into something then that could be usable rather than to screw it up with all this power that is given. And I see there's a fantastic amount of power and ability of this program to spread this thing that is love. So you're a great group here. I appreciate being here. And thank you much. I love you.